stories, Iran says reaching a sustainable deal on the revival of the JCPOA requires practical and verifiable measures by the United States. Iraqi media say a major U.S. military base near the capital, Baghdad, has come under a rocket attack. And a top Russian official warns of NATO's nuclear threat as the standoff over Ukraine shows no sign of letting up. Welcome to the program. Iran says it has a serious will to reach, in the shortest possible time, a good agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or better known as the JCPOA. The comment was made by the Iranian foreign minister, who spoke with UN Chief Antonio Guterres on the phone. Hossein Amir Abdullahian described as positive the process of the ongoing talks in Vienna on the JCPOA revival talks and the removal of sanctions. He pointed out to a lack of trust in the U.S., saying a reliable and lasting agreement requires practical, tangible, and verifiable measures by the West and Washington. Guterres, for his part, welcomed any progress in the Vienna talks, which are underway between Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories. The U.S. is taking part in the talks indirectly because it withdrew from the 2015 deal and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Iraqi media say a military base housing American forces near Baghdad's international airport has come under attack. According to the media reports, the base known as Camp Victory was attacked by 6 rockets. Still no word on possible casualties or material damage. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility either. Camp Victory and other U.S. military bases in Iraq have frequently been attacked in the past months. The incidents have grown since the U.S. assassinated top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and a senior Iraqi commander in January of 2020. Both were key anti-terror icons. The assassination gave a rise to calls for the withdrawal of American forces from Iraq. The Syrian military prosecution says it's obtained and documented evidence on numerous U.S. violations in Syria during the years-long war. It also vowed to judicially pursue all Americans who committed crimes or undermined the state's sovereignty. Muhammad Ali is in Damascus.
It's what occupation looks like. U.S. troops wander around an independent country without any legal justification, invitation, or U.N. mandate. The U.S. officially intervened in Syria in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh, something Syria dismisses as lies. The military prosecution in Syria held a press conference asserting it has collected evidence of U.S.-Daesh cooperation in Syria.
The military prosecution in Syria obtained material evidence that the U.S. has almost direct control over Daesh and its terrorist activities in Syria using its illegal base in Al-Tanf. We have proof that many Daesh terrorists are being trained by U.S. forces in that base. We monitor the terrorists moving freely there with their weapons and vehicles.
For years, the U.S. has been looting Syria's oil after occupying areas in the oil-rich north and northeastern territories. The military prosecution in Syria vowed to judicially pursue the U.S. for all its crimes.
The result of our investigations into the U.S. violations in Syria, which led to destruction and casualties, threat to our sovereignty, theft of oil and wheat, illegitimate sanctions, and control over Daesh on territories of a U.N. member state, enables us in the near future to officially make accusations against the U.S. administration and its forces in Syria.
The military prosecution also accused the U.S. of promoting division by supporting a separatist ideology among the so-called SDF, providing them with weapons and ensuring they get all Syria's oil, let alone the U.S. airstrikes, which killed or displaced thousands of Syrians and destroyed its infrastructure. It hasn't been a day or two, a month or a year. It's been almost 8 uninterrupted years of U.S. violations in Syria, at least since the intervention of the U.S.-led coalition. But regardless of how much time they're planning to stay, Syrian officials don't spare a chance to reiterate that their country will be liberated from terrorism and illegal foreign presence. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
For decades, the Israeli regime has oppressed the people of West Asia, from occupying Palestinian and Lebanese territories to carrying out deadly airstrikes against Syria. Israel has done it all. And apparently, there is no accountability for these actions. Here's a report.
The Golan Heights, a mountainous terrain to the west of Syria. It has been recognized as Syrian territory ever since the country achieved its independence from the Ottoman Empire in 1946. However, in 1967, Israel waged a full-scale war against Arab countries, during which it occupied a large swathe of Golan. 4 years later, the regime annexed the areas it had occupied. All but a few countries have never recognized that decision. Iran, for one, has always condemned the illegal occupation of Golan. The country's UN envoy has called on the Security Council to condemn a recent Israeli cabinet meeting on the occupied land and compel Tel Aviv to end its occupation of the Syrian territory. Similarly, the Syrian UN envoy has also strongly criticized Israel for its actions in the occupied Golan Heights.
We would like to stress that the Security Council must act firmly and swiftly to, first, ensure the respect of its resolutions and other UN resolutions on the occupied Syrian Golan and ensure the implementation of such resolutions to put an end to the Israeli occupation and counter any Israeli schemes aimed at building thousands of new settlements in Golan and doubling the number of settlers living there. They must compel Israel, the occupying power, to put an end to its repetitive hysterical attacks against the territories of the Syrian Arab Republic and hold it accountable for such attacks.
Israel has also regularly carried out deadly airstrikes on Syria over the past decade, causing death and destruction to the already war-battered nation. But the Israeli regime's atrocities do not end with Syria. For decades now, Palestinians have experienced the regime's continued occupation and aggression. Israel has relentlessly expanded its settlements in the occupied West Bank in defiance of international law, driving Palestinians out of their ancestral homes. Analysts believe these measures are part of a systematic oppression.
It just shows that the belligerence of the establishment and the use of NGOs and religious extremist organizations, Jewish religious extremist organizations, is just something which is part of the systemic discrimination, institutionalized oppression of Palestinians who are living under the rule of the Israeli regime.
The regime has also inflicted a heavy loss of life on the people of Palestine during its decades-long occupation. Thousands have been killed at the hands of Israeli forces and in the regime's attacks on the Gaza Strip and the rest of the occupied lands. Lebanon has also been a victim of Israeli aggression. Even now, some parts of the Arab country, namely Sheba Farms, remain under Israeli occupation. But why has the regime not been held accountable for its unlawful practices? A simple answer would be the United States' unwavering and unconditional support for Israel. Washington has blocked dozens of resolutions critical of the regime in the UN Security Council while providing Tel Aviv with advanced weaponry. Also, the U.S. has recognized Israel's sovereignty over the Syrian Golan Heights, despite opposition from the United Nations. As Israel enjoys the U.S.'s full support, it is hard to imagine an end to the regime's aggression against the people of the region in the near future. But it remains to be seen how much longer Israel will be able to get away with its atrocities as the international community becomes more aware of the crimes it's committing almost on a daily basis in territories under its military occupation.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says his country is not seeking war with neighboring Ukraine.
If it depends on Russia, there will be no war. We do not want wars, but neither will we allow for our interest to be blatantly violated, for our interest to be ignored.
Lavrov was speaking at a press conference in Moscow a day after the U.S. and NATO responded to the security demands raised by Russia. He said U.S. proposals were better than those received from NATO. Lavrov added Russia is analyzing the proposals and President Vladimir Putin will decide how to respond. On Thursday, the top Russian diplomat said both NATO and American proposals had failed to address his country's concerns over the Western military alliance's expansion eastward. Russia also wants NATO to reject Ukraine's membership bid. The West accuses Russia of a troop buildup at the border to invade Ukraine. Russia says the move is aimed at self-defense. They've been at odds over Ukraine for weeks now. Russia says the Western military alliance, NATO, is developing the capacity for nuclear strikes against Russian territory. The country's top arms control official, Vladimir Yermakov, has spoken of what he called joint nuclear missions between NATO countries. He says in those missions, non-nuclear NATO members are housing American B-61 nuclear bombs. The Russian official said the same members are taking part in training sessions to develop American nuclear capabilities aimed at his country. He has urged an end to those missions and says all American nuclear warplanes, weapons, must return to U.S. territory. The Russian official said these demands were included in a list Moscow presented to the West in December. Elsewhere, North Korea confirms its latest missile launches amid growing tensions with the United States over the country's nuclear weapons program. State media KCNA said one of the tests was an upgraded long-range cruise missile and the other one was a warhead of a tactical guided missile. On Wednesday, the South Korean military said it detected the launch of two short-range ballistic missiles. The launches drew condemnation from the United States. North Korea has recently said it will bolster its defenses against the United States and consider resuming all temporarily suspended activities.
This time in January, North Korea Thursday conducted a round of ballistic missiles testing, firing two short-range rockets off its east coast. Analysts suggest North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants to show his people he's their defender, although the tests have several purposes.
They're trying to make a point regarding the South Korean presidential election. They're trying, I think, to try to intimidate South Koreans into thinking, look, you've got to come to terms with us, the North Koreans.
Since late 2017, North Korea has not conducted a long-range missile test or a nuclear test in the hopes of making a deal with former U.S. President Donald Trump on sanctions relief. No deal has materialized. And leader Kim has recently indicated the moratorium on long-range missile testing and nuclear testing has expired.
He said that he might want to go beyond simply testing missiles, implying, not saying directly, but implying that he might want to test an intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM, that's capable of carrying a warhead to the United States. And he might even want to have another underground nuclear test.
The U.S. has criticized the recent testing, while China places the blame for tensions on the U.S. reliance on sanctions on North Korea. South Koreans will head to the polls to elect a new president on March 9th. With North Korea conducting six rounds of missile tests in just the past month, security, military affairs, and relations between Seoul and Pyongyang are likely to figure heavily in that election. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Well, South Korea's COVID cases keep surging, with the country logging yet another record in its daily infections. South Korea posted more than 16,000 new infections for Thursday. That's the highest daily case number there since the start of the pandemic. Daily COVID infections hit record highs on Wednesday and Tuesday as well. They have been rising steadily in the past 2 weeks because of the Omicron variant that is highly contagious. Health authorities in South Korea are now warning that daily caseloads could surge to five-digit figures in the coming weeks if the current pace of the Omicron spreads continues. The government has extended restrictions on businesses to contain the virus. We did not know where we were going. We didn't know what was going to happen to us. These were the sentiments of hundreds, if not thousands, of Indigenous children in Canada who were sent off to boarding schools by force, ripping children from their families. The authorities back then sought to forcibly assimilate them into the quote-unquote Canadian culture, but many of these children died in such residential schools with their mass graves uncovered to this day, and many calling it a genocide.
An indigenous community in Canada has announced the discovery of 93 potential unmarked graves on the site of a former residential school. This is the latest discovery of remains of scores of indigenous children over the past year. Williams Lake First Nation announced that preliminary results of the first phase of a geophysical search at St. Joseph Mission Residential School uncovered 93 unmarked grave sites. To date, 93 reflections have been recorded at the St. Joseph's Mission. All of them display varying characteristics indicative of potential human burials. Investigators used a range of geophysical techniques in their search, including ground-penetrating radar. Only 14 out of approximately 470 hectares have been searched so far. Research has uncovered stories of murder, systemic torture, starvation, rape, and sexual assault at the residential school. Children suffered rotten food, fire hazards, overcrowding, pests, and illness, and there were reports of students trying to take their own lives. Authorities often chose not to investigate the atrocities. Hundreds of unmarked graves have already been discovered at former residential school sites across Canada since May. It was announced that 215 unmarked graves at the former Kamloops Indian Residential School were uncovered. That discovery fueled widespread calls for justice and accountability for the victims and survivors of the forced assimilation institutions, as well as demands that the Canadian government release all records pertaining to the facilities.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran originates from Leather's anti-arrogance and colonialist spirit. This is the part of a televised speech delivered on January 9, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the anniversary of an uprising by the people of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The January 9th uprising was a brilliant combination of zeal and rationality. I wish to present a brief explanation to make it clear how successful this uprising has been in the area of rationality. The goal of the tyrants was to shatter Imam's sanctity. They did not have access to his physical body because at that time Imam resided in Najaf, but they felt they could question and insult his name, his memory, and his sanctity. They felt the opportunity was right and started, so it was a calculated move. In other words, they had hatched a plot and formulated a plan before starting. However, the people of Qom foiled their plan. The action of the people of Qom ruined the enemy's calculations. The Quran says, "But it is the faithful who are the outmaneuvered ones." The Holy Quran, Surah 52, verse 42. They hatched a plot, but it ended to their own disadvantage.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They wanted to break Imam, but their move caused Imam to achieve a more powerful, brilliant appearance. They wanted to weaken Imam's relationship with the people, but this relationship became stronger. They wanted to weaken the movement, but the movement became stronger. In fact, the people's move guaranteed that the calculations they had made would end in this result. I am not saying that each and every person who came into the streets had made this calculation, but behind that collective movement, which was inspired by God the Exalted, there existed an important calculation that disrupted and shattered the enemy's calculations. That is, the same person who described Iran as an island of stability on January the 1st, 1978, Carter was forced to send General Haizer to Tehran in order to extinguish the movement at any cost, with a coup or by massacring the people. Of course, thankfully, they were unsuccessful in that move as well, since they failed to prevent the revolution from being successful. The US's wrong calculations in their system of calculations keep continuing.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all.
Midstream.
More than 100 raids on different governorates of Yemen were carried out by the Saudi coalition forces within 24 hours last week between Wednesday and Friday, causing the death of dozens, wounding hundreds, and causing severe damage to entire neighborhoods. The insane raids targeted homes and civilian facilities in Saada, Hudaydah, Ma'rib, and Sana'a, and cut off the internet from a country of 30 million humans after destroying Yemen's only internet provider located in Hudaydah. All that while the world has exchanged blood for oil. A world where Yemeni human life is worthless. A world that handed over the hammer of justice to the arrogant vile of the earth, who are called the owners of majesties, eminences, and sovereignty. Thus was the day when the UN Security Council condemned the Yemeni rightful retaliation to the UAE-Saudi aggression by targeting the oil reservoir in Abu Dhabi, while hundreds of martyrs and wounded innocent civilians never even moved that council. Massacres against humanity committed by the US-led Saudi Emirati aggression on Yemen, from Saada to Hudaydah and Sana'a, ambulance crews were unable to rescue those trapped under the rubble, while nearly 100 martyrs and hundreds of wounded have been counted so far, including at least 30 children. What added salt to the injury of the Yemenis was that the massacres of last week did not find a place on the agendas of the officials, especially the Arab ones, as well as the governments of the world and those who never miss a chance to scream about freedoms and human rights everywhere. With all the scenes of destruction now taking place on the heads of children in Yemen, in Saada, Hudaydah, and Sana'a, is it enough to describe the war as absurd? It's a pointless war, without results, and it will never reach its declared or hidden goals. Don't get me wrong, this is not an emotional statement. Saudi Arabia has spent on its war against Yemen more than $412 billion over 5 years from 2015 to 2020 and did not achieve the results that it announced its ability to achieve within weeks, according to its crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. The United Arab Emirates followed the same path when it entered the war and allocated nearly 20% of its government spending to military expenditures. And the result was nothing but a state of constant worry that spread among those investing in its cities. So yes, this U.S.-led Saudi Emirati war against all of Yemen is least to say absurd, because its perpetrators insist on repeating the same actions using the same means while hoping for different results. That is not only absurd, that's crazy. Yet what could absurdity mean for the victims, the martyrs, and the bereaved who lost their homes and loved ones and suffered through waves of ancient diseases due to an inhumane blockade? Yemenis are not numbers and statistics of missing victims and martyrs. It is not a cover photo depicting shattered buildings and torn streets. Yemen is us. We are Yemen. Our blood is one, our destiny is one, our enemy is one. Our victory is coming, God willing. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Details continue to unfold about the Emirati-Saudi bloodbath in retaliation to Ansarullah's Yemen cyclone operation. The U.S.-led Emirati-Saudi aggression targeted civilian objects in the capital Sana'a in violent attacks that appeared to be similar to the serial attacks that the city was previously subjected to during the first days of the war in late March of 2015. Now, air raids hit various neighborhoods of the capital Sana'a, where population exceeds 4 million humans, with F-16 and F-15 war jets. More than 100 were martyred and more than 120 wounded as a result of the raids of the Saudi coalition on a central prison in Sa'da. Further west in Hudaydah, 6 martyrs, including 3 children and 18 wounded, most of whom are children, is the latest toll of the coalition's crime in Al-Muasalat neighborhood. All that in complete internet outage in Yemen after the aggression targeted the international telecommunication and internet gateway in Hudaydah, which is Yemen's only internet provider. To discuss this issue and much more with us from London is Ms. Isra Al-Khas, human rights advocate. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Isra. Now, a genocide in Yemen during the past week with scores martyred in Sana'a, Sa'da, and Hudaydah under constant hysterical bombing by the U.S. Saudi Emirati-led aggression on the country, resulting in more than an addition of 150 deaths up until now. We don't know if there's more people under the rubble, including at least 30 children. Will such war crimes at least deter Ansarullah from returning fire back at any state that is aggressive towards Yemen, that is actually wreaking havoc inside of Yemen? We did see that they retaliated with a second cyclone, but would that be it, or will they continue?
Of course, the response has been settled with the second Yemen hurricane operation. We saw it on the news that was coming out of the UAE capital and the Saudi cities, starting with a response to the massacres that were committed in Sana'a, Hudaydah, and Sa'da. However, the statements of officials and leaders within Ansarullah say that the Yemeni response will not stop at this point, and that the escalation described by the forces of the coalition of aggression is basically a Yemeni response to the aggression itself. Every day, the Yemeni armed forces confirmed that the range of response is open as long as the aggression continues, and this was confirmed in the last statement issued on Monday by Brigadier General Yahya al-Sari, spokesman of the Yemeni armed forces. He clearly said that the response to the Emiratis will not stop here, rather it is only the beginning of the response. This was clarified by the recent statement of the Ansarullah Political Council. Therefore, what necessitated this response was the massacres perpetrated by the aggression. As long as this aggression continues, the pretext of Ansarullah's right for self-defense continues, and the utilization of this resistance continues.
But Ms. Isra, massacre after the other is committed in Yemen against the Yemeni people, especially the last one, which is they are now out of reach with the world. They are out of touch with the world because of the complete internet outage, because Saudi jets went along and bombed Yemen's only internet service provider in Hudaydah, and it's the International Telecommunications and Internet Gateway. That is for sure another kind of war crime, because they're trying to kill people without allowing the media to see it. But the United Nations Security Council is silent again. I mean, they might issue some sort of a statement saying, okay, we don't like people being killed, but this is a holocaust, for the love of God. Why is Yemen not even on the map for these people?
I'm totally correct. Yemen is not on the map of the United Nations, nor on the political map of the Security Council, and this is not surprising at all. It is certainly painful, because victimization is difficult, but it's not surprising. Well, let's look at the different nations in this world. Does the UN Security Council represent all these peoples, especially the people of West Asia? Definitely not. Or even all the peoples of the world? No. It doesn't represent them. It is a council for managing political deals for major countries, especially the United States of America. This council is the same council that legitimizes wars under the pretext of maintaining global peace and security, and finds legal solutions and reprehensible justifications to give a green light to perpetuate more massacres in this region. And this is the same Security Council that does not see the Iranian people, who have been subjected to sanctions for more than four decades because of the political choices of this people. This is the same council also that could not prevent the United States from invading Iraq in 2003. And it is the same Security Council that offered the Palestinians nothing but expressions of concern in equating the victim with the perpetrator. It is the Security Council itself which does not see the people of Latin America or hear about the famines and crimes that are being committed in African countries. This is the Security Council. The process of international solidarity, which takes place sometimes in the name of democracy and other times in the name of human rights, has yielded nothing. The Security Council was not able to liberate Gaza. The resistance did so, just as the case in the south of Lebanon. It was the resistance that actually regained the land and defeated the occupation.
And it seems the same thing is happening in Yemen, Israel, because the Yemeni armed forces responded to the massacres committed by the forces of aggression with a second hurricane of Yemen against both the United Arab Emirates and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. We did see that a plunge in stock markets in the Persian Gulf Arab states was happening this morning, or the morning of Monday. The response was quick after the threats of Brigadier General Yahya Sariya, who advised foreign companies to actually leave Emirates because he says it is not safe. Do you think that this response will compel them, force the aggression to come and sit on the table of dialogue, or maybe we will see an unleash of madness of the Saudi Emirati war machine?
Dear Marwa, if you would allow me, I have to distinguish between the Saudi position in this particular section and the UAE position. Will this retaliation drag the two sides to the negotiation table? Well, certainly the two sides need to find a political way out of the Yemeni quagmire. But we need to understand a very important matter. Before the Yemeni response and basically the explicit promise of Brigadier General Yahya al-Sari, the channels of communication between the Emiratis and the decision-making capitals, who are allies of Ansarullah, did not stop. Tahnoun bin Zayed contacted Tehran, Baghdad, and even the Syrian capital, Damascus. Also, the Lebanese newspaper, Al-Akhbar, reported that there are channels of communication with Hezbollah in Lebanon. All of these channels were needed by the children of Zayed in order to be used to prevent the Yemeni retaliation, which we all witnessed at dawn on Monday. Nevertheless, there are Emirati positions that we hear and are being transmitted that the Emiratis basically did not commit the recent massacres, and that the Americans and Saudis committed them, and that they were the ones who actually even pushed the Emirati giant brigade in Shabwa. If there was an Emirati disavowal of the massacres before the second Yemeni response, let alone after the operation and after seeing how this response impacted UAE's economy. This country cannot withstand even a third Yemeni response. It is a country that is affected by a tweet and by breaking news. We all saw a simple tweet by the director of the office of the Yemeni presidency, Mr. Ahmed Hamid, who asked a single question. What do you know about Burj Khalifa? In a matter of minutes, we saw how the world was shaken and began wailing about it.
Well, it seems to be that the upcoming couple of days will be decisive for an entire nation in the United Arab Emirates, only because of a couple of ballistic missiles from the resistance in Yemen. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have on. Thank you very much from London, Ms. Isra Al-Fas, human rights advocate, for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Turkey trying to get closer to the Israeli entity.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
While responding to questions about changes in diplomatic relations with Israel, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said that his office was having talks with Isaac Herzog, the occupation's president, and that he may be visiting Turkey soon. Emphasizing similar willingness on the Israeli side for fully normalizing bilateral relations, Erdogan said that Prime Minister Naftali Bennett also has a positive approach. Now, look no further than the strong alliance forged in recent years between the Israeli entity, Greece, and Cyprus, especially in the domains of security and energy, to understand Turkey's interest in selling out on Palestine once and for all. The Israeli occupation has clarified lately that any rapprochement with Turkey will not come at the expense of its strong ties with Cyprus and Greece. Turkey seeks closer ties with the Israeli entity in this following report.
After El Monitor revealed earlier a report about secret talks between Turkey and Israel, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced the possibility of a visit by the Israeli president to Turkey. As part of propaganda about the visit, Turkey announced it unilaterally via the far-right pro-government media outlet Daily Sabah. That article was then recycled by reports in Israeli media about Turkish President Erdogan claiming the visit would happen. Erdogan even said during a press conference with his Serbian counterpart Aleksandar Vučić in the Turkish capital Ankara last week that there are talks with the Israeli president and it is possible that he will have a visit to Turkey. On the possibility of cooperation with Israel in the Eastern Mediterranean, Erdogan said they aim to make progress through positive approaches. The Turkish president then stressed that Ankara will do everything it can if this matter is based on mutual profit. The very next day, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu spoke with Israel's Foreign Minister Yair Lapid. Reports claimed it was the first call at the ministerial level in 13 years. Meanwhile, Ankara wants Tel Aviv to know that it is celebrating the decision by the U.S. to no longer support an Israel-Greece gas pipeline. The message is that Palestine's stolen natural gas by Israel now has nowhere to go and will have to go through Turkey. This is not the first time Ankara floated this idea of ties with Israel. It has done so several times over the past years, almost always timed to prevent Israel-Greece-Cyprus natural gas deals. Back in 2019 and early 2020, Turkey floated ideas about reconciliation when Israel and Greece were showing growing ties. It didn't want the East Med gas pipeline to come into fruition. It also sought to reach out to Israel when it was clear that Egypt, the UAE, France, Cyprus, and Greece were going to sign off on a declaration expressing concerns about Ankara's threats in the Eastern Mediterranean. In May 2020, Turkey again said it would reconcile with Israel. It even fed media entirely unsubstantiated stories about how Ankara had clashed with Hezbollah in Syria and that Israel might share common views there about Iran's role. The obvious goal for Turkey is for Israeli gas to flow through Turkey. However, when talking about Turkish-Israeli relations, the economic, commercial, and tourism aspects cannot be overlooked, and the role of each of them in strengthening those relations, especially when it comes to major global projects related to the field of energy, despite the fact that it is stolen Palestinian energy. In addition, cooperation in the security and military fields is considered a mainstay in the relations between the two parties. This begs the question of Turkey's real intentions towards Palestine rather than towards the Israeli occupation, given that no evidence is needed to spot the interest in the latter rather than the former.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Aleppo is Sarkis Kasarjian, journalist expert in Turkish affairs. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Sarkis. Now, the Israeli media confirmed Isaac Herzog's visit to Turkey and said that the latter, whom Erdogan had called twice before now, had received an official invitation from Turkey and would soon respond to that invitation. How is it that how is it going to be beneficial in any way towards Turkey? I mean, when Israel has indeed announced that any rapprochement with Turkey will not affect its ties with Cyprus and Greece.
Well, Israel did issue a statement regarding its relations with Cyprus and Greece and their inability to be affected by the entity's relations with Turkey, especially that the Israeli-Greek relations are new ones that have only developed in the past decade, part of which in a reaction to the bad relationship between Tel Aviv and Ankara. But in my view, the relationship between Turkey and Israel will in fact affect the latter's relations with Cyprus and Greece due to the historical tension between Turkey and Greece, which has recently escalated. But I think that the European Union on the one hand and Tel Aviv on the other are counting on the possibility of changing the Turkish approach towards the Greek hotspot, and this of course depends on the extent of European pressures that can be activated against Turkey to compel it to behave more moderately or more in line with good neighborly relations with Greece. I believe the Turkish-Israeli relations are the result of serious shifts in the developments of the region. First, in terms of a change in the Turkish foreign policy on the one hand, and secondly, I think that the American rejection of the project to transport gas from Israel via pipelines to Cyprus and Greece, which completely ignored Turkey, also affected the acceleration of seeking better ties between Israel and Turkey. And thirdly, I think that the excellent relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates on the one hand and the Turkish-Emirati normalization on the other hand contributed to the development of Turkish-Israeli relations. It's important to note that, despite the tension between the two parties that prevailed during the past decade, trade between Turkey and Israel, tourist trips and military agreements remained active at the highest levels.
Mr. Sarkis, but some explain this rapprochement as a sudden development in the Turkish position towards the Israeli entity. But if we actually go back to the pages of history after the establishment of the Zionist entity in the Arab Muslim land of Palestine, we see that Turkey is the first Islamic country to recognize this entity in March of 1949, 10 months after its emergence in Palestine. And since that date, it has not hesitated to conclude military and political agreements. So what's new with these relations then?
It's true as you mentioned, that Turkey was the first country to recognize the establishment of the Israeli entity. It was the first Islamic and regional country to do so. What's new in the relationship is a change in the tone of the Turkish discourse. I mean, during the last decade, Turkey built its policy on the neo-Ottoman rhetoric. This rhetoric, of course, obliges Ankara to take formal anti-Israel positions. As I mentioned earlier, trade remained as is between them. Commercial relations between the two parties remained unchanged, and even transit and military agreements also remained unchanged. What changed was only the rhetoric and diplomatic representations, and this is due to the necessity of Turkish foreign policy back then. Today, Turkey has modified this discourse due to the pressing economic conditions at home and as a part of the new policy announced by Erdogan, which is the policy of liquidating problems with neighboring countries and with regional powers. So that's just what has changed. Even during the years of tension between the two sides, Israeli pilots were training in Turkish airspace. Even the pride of the Turkish industry, and I mean here, the war spy drones, are originally an Israeli-made technology, and their manufacturing was a joint project between Ankara and Tel Aviv.
Well, but we still see, Mr. Sakis, that Turkey keeps utilizing its media propaganda machine to insinuate that any update ties with Israel will not affect its support to Palestine and the Palestinian resistance, especially in Gaza. Mind you, Turkey was not even able to break the sea blockade against Gaza in 2009 with a peaceful flotilla. Then why not just tell the truth like other Persian Gulf Arab states who openly say that the Palestinian cause is no longer any interest for them? So why doesn't Turkey say it?
Well, that is because Turkey's policy is based on this particular issue. Turkey does not want to lose the Palestinian card that it constantly uses to put pressure on Tel Aviv and on other countries in the region. Erdogan in particular built his policy on a set of issues or files. One of the most important files is the Palestinian one. Turkey cannot continue its Islamic policy between two brackets without the existence of the Palestinian cause in its speech. Therefore, Turkey is compelled to talk about this issue. But on the ground, realistically, since the events of 2009, the Davos Conference, and the Mavi Marmara Flotilla, Turkey has not submitted anything new regarding Palestine. The Turkish discourse, especially towards the internal public opinion, and in particular, the discourse of the Justice and Development Party, and even the popular base of this party, which consists of conservatives, is forced not to abandon the issue of Palestine in the media, or else it will lose a lot of popularity at home, and this will of course affect the results of the upcoming elections in 2023. Therefore, I think that will not change its discourse in the media, but on the ground, there is nothing new.
Well, we will see what will happen after the Isaac Herzog visit to Turkey. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Sakis Kasarjian, journalist, expert in Turkish affairs, for joining us from Aleppo to discuss this issue. Thank you very much for your contribution. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream. Salam.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light."
and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint,
a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my two guests, as always, joining me in the studio, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah, criticizing the movie, The Girl Who Believes in Miracles. Brother Hussein, salam alaikum, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam, glad to be here.
Welcome. Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. In this series of programs, Viewpoint, or the Movie Critique Program, we are mainly focusing on the religious concepts rather than the artistic features typical of so-called critical programs about arts and artistic characteristics of the movies. So our main purpose is to address those features and themes which are related about religion and God and whatsoever that goes with that territory. Let's take a listen to a part of the movie, The Girl Who Believes in Miracles, and we'll be back with the questions and its critique.
Do you speak to God often?
All the time. Don't you?
Well, not directly.
Not even in church?
Look, it's not healthy or fair to other people to pretend that you're actually having conversations with God.
I'm not pretending.
You just listened to a part of the movie, The Girl Who Believes in Miracles, in this program, Viewpoint, on IRIB English Radio. Sayyid Abdullah, is it possible to speak directly to God? You know, one of the interesting points with this movie, for me, was that how easily the priest of their parish, the girl's parish, or church, came to accept that a girl is able to like receive a miracle like this from God, if it happened really, like a blessing or something. But we've seen it in a lot of Christian movies that the priests refuse to accept that other people, other than the priests, or somebody who's religious in that way, or in the industry of, let's say, church, would be able to connect with God. It's very interesting that the priest here has a very soft and mild position toward other people than priests, than religious people, like talking to God, seeing God, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, before I answer your question whether kind of person talks to God directly, like you said, with the Christianity, the biggest lie that Christianity came up with, or the Christian theology was based on the fact that John, he saw God, and God spoke to him, and then he started the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
So the actual faith itself is based on this lie that you can see and talk to God directly. And every priest lives that lie, that he talks to God. And you can hear it, like, even, like, not in the movies, like, in real life, like, God spoke to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who the hell are you to for God to speak to you? What do you have? What kind of honor do you have that God speaks to you directly?
Mm-hmm.
So God never speaks to these people. These people just manipulating and using people's love for God. And, you know, they're just being cunning in this regard.
Mm-hmm.
They're on, and that's why that you made the point. That's why when someone says, I spoke to God, like, no, God would never speak to you. He only speaks to us because I'm like, why? Because you're the chosen ones?
Yes.
What, you know, what's so special about you? Yeah. What, because you can read the Bible? I can read the Bible.
Who gave you the license?
Yeah, who gave you the license? Exactly. It's not a club. It's not an exclusive club to you guys. So this is just
nonsense. The VIP or something.
Exactly. So this is just a nonsense Christianity came up with, and sadly they believe. But can anyone talk to God? Of course, anyone can talk to God.
I see.
Any human being can do it, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is your creator, he's my creator. Like we, if we can use the word, he's our father, right?
Mm-hmm.
We all can speak to our father.
Yes.
But whether he replies to you or not, that's a different issue. Depends, yes, depending on how good you are.
Yes.
Right. Sometimes I have
level of connection.
Yeah. So for let's assume I have 2-3 kids, and one of my kids very naughty, and he's like, dad, like I just decided to ignore him. I don't want to talk to him because he's just, you know, he's just bugging me. And one of my girls, she's really nice and I love her very much. Like the minute she says, dad, I was like, yes, Habibti, what is it?
Uh-huh.
Right. So yeah, so Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala could be the same. But can we all speak to him? Obviously we can. Allah wants us to all speak to him. And
hence
his
the word friends of God. We have awliya Allah, you know?
Yeah,
friends
we
of
we
God.
Have,
if
we
you
have
are a
many,
friend with God.
We have actually many levels. Even the prophets themselves, they in different ranks. And each rank, for example, they would have a specific gift, and they based on that. So some Allah talks to, some Allah sees, some Allah,
yes,
you know,
exactly,
he would have intimacy with them, like on a personal level, and so on and so forth. Same thing with us as human beings. We all can talk to God, but the response is sometimes we can feel it, sometimes we can see it, sometimes I don't know. Depends
yes
on how good you are. You could even hear it.
Okay. Let's take a listen to a part of the movie, The Girl Believes in Miracles, and then we'll come back with its critique.
I'm just not sure what will happen to me when I die.
Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die.
Will my soul go to heaven? Even if I'm really scared of dying.
Everyone's afraid to die. Even the bravest people.
Was Jesus afraid?
He was. But he was comforted by knowing that he would live again. And you should feel the same way too.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. You just listened to a part Brother was saying that is talking about death as being scary. Is death really scary, frightening? Should we be afraid of dying?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, I haven't really died yet, so I can't answer that question completely truthfully. But, of course, death is part of life. It's actually a quote from the movie. And I guess it could be scary because, you know, it's the conclusion of what you've, you know, done in your entire existence, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It can be pretty scary, but to those with strong faiths, it's nothing to fear.
Yes. And there is a very nice academic work, a seminal one, done by Elizabeth Kobler Ross. This lady has worked on death to a very extensive level, and I advise our audience, in fact, to refer to it and read it. Let's take another listen to another part of the movie, and then we'll be back.
I don't understand. I just don't understand why you would make her so perfect and then snatch her away from us. I do not understand it. God, I am asking you. No. I'm begging you. Please don't do this. Please don't do this. Don't take Sarah. If you need somebody, take me. Stop my heart right here. It's okay. But please don't take Sarah.
You just listened to a part of the movie, The Girl Who Believes in Miracles, at 2021. New American movie directed by Richard Quarle. In this program, Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. Sayyid Abdullah, can we really digest and understand God's work? Giving a beautiful daughter, for example, to someone, all right, and then take it back. Like, is God's providence comprehensible to us? Or is God human-like? Like, does he have human characteristics like us? Like, what kind of God gives a beautiful daughter to someone and then takes it away from
him? Takes her away. Can we comprehend God's work to some extent? We can, and to some extent,